I'm John Kroll. Today, in the special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk about the life and legacy of Paul McNutt, one of the most powerful, successful, and controversial governors in Indiana history. He led the state during some of the darkest days of the Great Depression, when he was lauded as the state savior by some and derided as a Hoosier Hitler by others. He emerged as a rival, sometimes friendly, sometimes not, of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and was instrumental in saving the lives of many Jews during World War II, becoming a kind of Hoosier Schindler. We will talk about this complex Indiana figure with the author of a splendid new biography of Paul McNutt, Dean J. Kutlowski, and former Indianapolis Deputy Mayor John Krause, McNutt's cousin and a man who helped midwife the biography. Because this is a recorded show, we won't be taking questions or comments, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded show, so we won't be taking calls, emails, or social media messages or questions. We're going to be talking about the life and legacy of Indiana Governor Paul McNutt. We have with us today his biographer, Dean Kutlowski, and John Krause, who has an interesting family connection. The springboard for the program is the biography, Paul V. McNutt and the Age of FDR. Dean, I've got to say, looking at the cover, having read the book and knowing a little bit now about McNutt's character and personality, how do you think that he would feel about the fact that FDR actually has larger type size on the cover of the book than McNutt himself? Dean?
It's an interesting story. You know, I was thinking about it. Gets me into the subject of the title of the book.
Yes.
And you know something? If you can't be clever, be clear. Mm-hmm. And I wanted something a little catchier, you know. The problem is with McNutt, he didn't have a nickname that could really encompass his career.
Like Wendell Willkie or...
No, but Robert Taft was Mr. Republican.
Yeah.
You know, McNutt was not Mr. Democrat or something like that. And there's not a pithy quote that's associated with him. I thought for a time of calling the book Heir Apparent, Paul V. McNutt in the Age of FDR, because he saw himself as Roosevelt's heir apparent. But that's only one part of a really multifaceted career. So I stuck with a very simple title. And in the introduction, I want the readers to think of three invisible accent marks on the title. First, Paul V. McNutt. Mm-hmm. It's a biography of Paul V. McNutt. He's at the core here. Secondly, in the title, you have age. So this, I think, really does revisit some of the major events of starting in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, even in the 1950s, but in particular the 30s and 40s, the age of FDR. And the last is Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt, in his McNutt's relationship with Franklin Roosevelt, is a big part of the story. And although McNutt was an important political figure in that period, the bottom line is he was overshadowed by Franklin Roosevelt.
And in some ways thwarted by him.
And thwarted by him. And, you know, John, it's very interesting. As I got into the subject, there were aspects of the Roosevelt era that I felt needed to be addressed, and this book was a good area. One of them is FDR's decision for a third term. Mm-hmm. It really hadn't been unpacked. A lot of historians said, well, we can't really know. It was probably sometime in the spring of 1940. But for McNutt, it was extremely important because I've identified an earlier date, which meant McNutt's presidential ambitions and his campaign really were moot. Because there's no way he was going to take the nomination away from FDR in 1940, and no way anyone else would. So I made sure I was very stubborn about this, and I said I'm gonna include that part in the book, and I think it works. There's a cartoon in the book mm-hmm. that really does show how the third term talk overshadowed the so-called McNutt boom, and there was a boom for him in 1939 and in 1940. So it's a long way of answering a very short question, but I'm not sure he would have liked
the fact that he's still in FDR's shadow to some degree.
Because, you know, after he was thwarted by Roosevelt at the 1940 convention, not only for president but for vice president, when he had a lot of support among the delegates, my sources and my evidence said he really didn't want to talk about that afterwards, after he left politics. His secretary, one of his last secretaries before he died, said it was a kind of taboo subject around the office. And she said, I never heard him talk about it. And very significantly, he reminded people in the offices he had, this is again late in his career, of his past in politics. He had a picture of Harry Truman up, but no picture of Franklin Roosevelt.
Okay. Well, and we probably ought to take a step back here and let people know who Paul McNutt was. He was governor of Indiana during the Great Depression from 33 to 37, but that really doesn't kind of encapsulate the whole of his life. So, Dean, could you walk us through that real quickly? Do a real quick summary of who he was and his significance in Indiana history.
I think the governorship is a good place to begin, and then we can work back and then forward, because I think people in Indiana would be fascinated with his governorship. It was an extremely powerful governor of the state, arguably the greatest governor and the most consequential governor in its history. During the Great Depression, really the architect of Indiana's welfare state and things is along those lines, very much cooperating with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal to bring federal relief projects to Indiana, among many other things. But leading up to the governorship, he was born in Franklin, Indiana. He grew up in Indianapolis briefly, and then Martinsville, Indiana, was really more of his hometown. So Martinsville gave the country two important Americans. It gave them John Wooden and Paul V. McNutt. And he went to Indiana University, was a student leader there. This is a time period when IU was not the mega university that it is today. And so he becomes a student leader there. And he goes to Harvard Law School. Again, what I was trying to get at is it's very rare for people to go to college at that point. We're talking about 1909 to 1913 and then going on to Harvard Law. So he has a really elite education for the average American. He goes into World War I. He volunteers. He emerges as a captain. He never sees action overseas, so he doesn't see the horrors of mechanized warfare. Mm-hmm. And he always remained a kind of idealistic about military service and service to your country. And service is one of the things that is a thread in McNutt's career, mm-hmm. along with ambition. Mm-hmm. Because he wanted more out of life. Coming back to Bloomington, he was a law instructor. And he becomes dean of the IU Law School. And he becomes active in the American Legion. So he was state and national commander of the American Legion. And when he became national commander, he became a national figure at a fairly young age, before he had reached the age of 40. Selected governor at 41. Again, many accomplishments as governor, but also building a very powerful political machine that was very controversial in some of its aspects. Well, he supported the New Deal, and he wasn't a supportive of FDR in 1932, but he was in 36. I'm talking about the 32 convention. In 36, FDR carries Indiana with McNutt's help. Now, McNutt cannot serve a second consecutive term.
Because the Indiana Constitution at the time prohibited that.
So he needed something to do, and there's talk about him becoming Secretary of War. And Roosevelt, there's considerable evidence of this, wanted to give him something and get him out of the country, and they made him High Commissioner to the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Which was still under...
Put him about as far away as you can get.
Yeah. Well, that's what somebody said. Somebody in the Roosevelt cabinet said, is that far enough away to send him? Yeah. Because he had a reputation, again, of looking for the next mountain to climb, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so he goes out to the Philippines. Now, the High Commissioner was the top U.S. post there. Mm-hmm. This was still under the U.S. flag. It's semi-independent. But if the listeners want to think of it as a colony, that's essentially what it was.
Yeah.
On the road to independence. Well, a number of things happened. One of the things that's come to light is that he helped 1,300 German and Austrian Jews mm-hmm. come to Manila in that period of 1937 to 39 when he was High Commissioner. We can talk about that a little later. He comes back to Washington. Roosevelt decides it's better to have him inside the tent rather than outside the tent.
Yeah.
And I won't continue continue with the metaphor, but I think people out there are familiar with politics have got the idea.
Yeah.
So he appoints him to the brand new newly created Federal Security Agency,
yeah,
which will later evolve into the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which will later become the Department of Health and Human Services. So he's the first head of that. Mm-hmm. And he oversees much of the New Deal. And people think, wow, FDR is doing some sort of laying on of hands and saying, you're the one. You are going to be my successor. It didn't quite work that way. Roosevelt very quietly pursued a third term. So McNutt's desire to succeed Roosevelt as the Democratic nominee for president doesn't happen. And then at the 1940 convention, he's aiming for vice president. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of delegate support for him. They don't want the alternative, which is Henry Wallace, who was rather liberal and, you know, had some baggage, yes, and wasn't seen as a real Democrat by a lot of people. Well, he doesn't get that, and he goes back to the Federal Security Agency. And there's stuff here that I didn't know. He oversees the Federal Security Agency in its formative period. And the listeners out here know we have a Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets involved in all sorts of security issues, including fighting biological warfare. Now, he's not intimately involved with that, but that's under his purview at the FSA. Issues of Social Security he has to deal with there. And also getting Americans healthy and physically fit and preparing for national defense and for war. That's something the Federal Security Agency did under McNutt, and he was rather interested in that. He was one of the people who helped to set up the USO. And again, a lot of people didn't know that. More importantly, during the war, he had something called the War Manpower Commission, which was a high-level agency simultaneously with the Federal Security Agency,
mm-hmm,
which really oversaw U.S. manpower policy, and it was a very unpleasant assignment. Mm-hmm. He sought it because of his ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to referee between the civilian sector of the economy and the military sector of the economy over probably the most precious resource the country had during the war. It wasn't oil or wasn't rubber. You know, you could find alternatives or make synthetic rubber, as the country did. But how do you make synthetic human beings?
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. So there was this intense competition, and he didn't fare in the eyes of many people very well. Well, he's ready to leave Washington. Roosevelt's dead in 1945. Truman makes him High Commissioner of the Philippines again. And he oversees Philippine independence, the transition from American sovereignty to Philippine sovereignty. And there's a very famous image in the Philippines of McNutt lowering the American flag and the new president of the Philippines, Manuel Rojas, raising the Philippine flag. And it's actually on the 100 peso Philippine note. And that's kind of an iconic image. But some of the listeners may remember that the U.S. had military bases in the Philippines, mm-hmm, for many years afterwards. It was McNutt who negotiated that bases treaty.
And all of that is an overview of the guy's significance. You know, one of the things that intrigued me, because if you're here in Indiana and you cover politics, you run into the names Paul McNutt. And, you know, it turns out his college classmate, Wendell Willkie, mm-hmm, too, which I've got to admit, just as a human thing, I found fascinating that the two of them had been friends for a long time. And, you know, at least at the beginning of the friendship, McNutt clearly was the sort of the dominant partner.
Well, I would put it this way. About McNutt and Willkie. It's fascinating. I wouldn't call them friends, but they were kind of friendly colleagues, somebody you would see and you're friendly with.
But Willkie's sending him notes at certain points saying, attaboy, go after it. Do whatever. You're the leader.
Think about it this way. McNutt is Prince William, yeah, and Wendell Willkie's Prince Harry. McNutt is the older son. He's a little bit older. He does he's buttoned down, clean shaven as a college student, does everything his parents want, everything along those lines. And Willkie's the sort of more fun younger brother with the rumpled suit. Barefoot boy of Wall Street and the tousled hair. I found out that's a cliche with Willkie. We could always talk about his tousled hair. Apparently women love the tousled hair. But, you know, Willkie was much more unconventional and sort of politically he's kind of a flash in the pan. He just emerges.
If you are just joining us, we are talking in this special recorded No Limits, about the life and legacy of former Indiana Governor Paul V. McNutt. The springboard for it is the publication of a splendid new biography about McNutt by Dean Kutlowski called Paul V. McNutt and the Age of FDR. We're also here with John Krause. Because this is a recorded show, we're not taking calls, questions, email messages, Facebook, or tweets. But we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. Again, I am John Krause. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krause, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded version of No Limits. We're talking about the life and legacy of former Indiana Governor Paul McNutt. We're talking with his biographer, Dean Kutlowski, and a person we're going to talk to here in a moment, John Krause, who is a cousin, but that really doesn't describe in any accurate fashion the family relationship or his relationship to this story. Again, because this is a recorded show, we're not taking calls or comments, questions or comments via phone or any kind of digital communication. Well, John, I'm going to throw it out there as simply as I can. Explain your connection to Paul McNutt.
Simply put, my great-grandfather and Paul's father were brothers, and my grandmother is a McNutt. Paul had one daughter, Louise, and Louise and I became very close friends. She never married. She spent 45 years in the State Department as the liaison for the Bureau of Far Eastern Affairs of the United Nations. And because of my interest in public service and Louise's career, we kind of hooked up together. Louise was always desiring something to be written about Paul to commemorate his place in history. Nothing had been written of any quality. The last 5 years of Louise's life, I took care of her in Washington and back and forth, and it was a task of love. But we'd had a conversation, and she'd hoped something would develop. Well, I administered her estate, and Louise had been a good friend of Herman Wells. Through Herman Wells, I got to know Jim Madison. And I went to Madison, who was the head of the he's in the history department at IU, and he's a renowned Indiana author.
Sort of the dean of Indiana historians.
Yeah,
right now,
he was. And he knew a lot about McNutt, and he said McNutt is probably one of the best or the best governor of Indiana. Well, I asked Madison if he'd write the book, and he was getting towards the end of his career, and he said no. And I said, well, then who would you recommend? Who is a Madison Jr. to do this? And we went through some iterations, and the long and short of it is he was proposing some people, and I wasn't really satisfied that it could be the book that Louise really wanted. And then finally he sent me a book written by one of his PhD students who graduated and was now in a faculty job in Maryland. And it was Nixon and Civil Rights. And I thought, how uncanny. I mean, that doesn't make sense, mm-hmm. Nixon and Civil Rights. So the PhD thesis was published by Harvard Press, which I think is a remarkable thing, you PhD, to be published that way. So I read it, and it kind of blew me away. I thought, this guy made a case. He made a very substantive case. It wasn't that Nixon was a champion of civil rights. Nixon was laissez-faire, and he allowed his lieutenants around him, who were a little more with it in terms of human relations, to have an impact on civil rights. I said, let's talk about this. And then that's how the relationship, which is well over a decade, even longer than that. Well, my late wife and I had to take care of unloading Louise's townhouse in Washington, D.C. She had over 50 years' worth of stuff. I mean, I came upon pictures of MacArthur and FDR, MacArthur and McNutt walking down the ocean in the Philippines when he was there, McNutt and FDR in touring cars, so that it all developed and it was just all this information. Well, as I was trying to come to grips with this, and Dean came out and went through all this, in the middle of all that was something that I was sitting in Louise's kitchen, and a fellow called me up and said he wanted to interview Louise. Turns out that he was writing a book about the Japanese invasion in the Philippines and how his father escaped the Philippines. Turns out, and I think you're going to be talking to Dean about this, but it turns out that that led me in a whole aspect of McNutt's life I never knew. And if I have to relate it back to just one kind of teaser, which we'll get into what Dean's going to talk about, is what the inaugural program of McNutt on the western steps of the State House in 1933. McNutt's a Methodist. We're just coming out of the Klan country in Indiana, and we're
still the only state in the country in which the Klan got control of the state government.
Yeah, I think there are probably some sheets in drawers and desks somewhere. but there is a Jewish rabbi who gives a prayer.
Yeah.
And I thought, what? That's kind of gutsy for this. Well, that and some other things, and this is like a long detective case, you know, Columbo of the 30s, but here I'm trying to relate all this. But it all makes sense, and it shows the career and the ambition of McNutt, because Dean talked about McNutt wanting to run for president. Well, he had a lot of chances after being governor to do something else, and after he went to the Philippines. I came upon a letter that Bowman Elder, this is the Elder family of the Chamber of Commerce, Bowman Elder and Frank McHale were authorized to offer McNutt the presidency of the New York Stock Exchange, and McNutt turned it down. Mm-hmm. Kathleen, his wife, was extremely disappointed because she said, public service doesn't pay a lot, and this is an opportunity to make some money. McNutt said, no, I want to go for public service. So that, in a number of things, really shaped his career, and I just became consumed by all the different things that Dean well knows. Well, the long and short of it is that it's a fine book. Indiana University Press has published it, but the aspect that Dean's going to talk about is also a national broadcast on PBS about an aspect, and I'm just going to defer and let you get into that and come back to this.
Well, and I should ask, though, because you were cousins, you obviously had a close relationship with his daughter. Did you ever meet McNutt himself?
No. I mean, he died in 1956. I was a little kid. But I do remember a story that Herman Wells told me. And McNutt and Herman Wells were buddies. And I think McNutt brought Herman Wells in. And McNutt could have been president of Indiana University. He didn't want to go for it, and because he didn't want to go for it, Herman Wells got it. So that they were close friends and rivals. But then another friend of McNutt's was Dwight Eisenhower, but he was stationed in the Philippines, and he was Colonel Eisenhower. Eisenhower became the president of Columbia University after he was the president, he called McNutt up and said, come down here. You've been involved in universities. You got to tell me what to do. And so between Paul McNutt and Herman Wells, they kind of gave Dwight Eisenhower the clues on how to be a president of a university. But there's so many intertwinings here that I think Hoosiers don't know the contribution that they gave to the world in McNutt and his ambition. And I think the book does a lot of justice to his career.
He, Dean, and I should say to our listeners, if you're just joining us, this is a recorded No Limits. We're not taking calls or questions or comments via social media or email. Dean, he was a complicated figure, though, because for all of these things that we've talked about, I mean, the rescue operation of the Jews in World War II, really pulling Indiana through the Depression, I mean, at a time when the whole thing could have just, the social structure could have collapsed, he did that. On the other hand, there is this sense with this guy that, A, he was always in a hurry. I mean, you know, the FDR quote that referred to him as the platinum-haired SOB. And you get the sense that there was a real restlessness. I mean, not many people think that being president of the United States should be your entry to the political world the first time you seek elective office or hold elective office. But he was looking at doing that. You also just get the sense from reading this that he could be a man of surpassing kindness at times, but also was one of those guys who could strut sitting down if he needed to.
I think a lot of that's true. I'll just play off of something John said about this letter that John found and that he shared with me about the New York Stock Exchange. McNutt talked about that with his top political aide, Frank McHale, who has really a kind of legendary status in the history.
There's another book there, too.
Yeah, there's probably. There are no Frank McHale papers that I know of that you could readily exploit. But he said, you know, what are my chances really becoming president? And I don't remember exactly the number. McHale said something like, well, one out of a thousand or one out of 100,000. And McNutt said, well, one out of 100,000 out of 120 million is pretty good, isn't it? So he really did want to go for it. He did have this restlessness. He seemed to be around very, very tight. Mary Switzer, who worked under him at the Federal Security Agency and wrote a number of very, very good letters, he influenced the lives of people who came after him. Mary Switzer became a very important federal bureaucrat. And in Washington, the Department of Health and Human Services main building in downtown D.C. is named after her. And he did a lot to promote her career. She said, you know, he's just like a little wind-up toy, mm-hmm. you know, and he's constantly in motion. And she said, I hope he gets what he so dearly desires, which was the presidency. So yes, he had that ambition. It rubbed people the wrong way. I do think he was arrogant, but I think the arrogance stemmed from a couple of things, the impression of arrogance. He's a very successful person. Mm-hmm. Got to think about people in the Depression. There were a lot of people, average people, who weren't terribly successful. And this man had the looks. We haven't even talked about the looks.
Yeah.
You know, people
talking about a matinee.
Yeah, the Hoosier Adonis, tall, tan, terrific, and all of that sort of thing. So he had that, the intellectual talents, you know, the physical gifts, the speaking ability. He was a very good public speaker. And yet he was also he's very successful on the one hand, but also very shy.
Yeah.
Very shy. And you know, when you put the two of those things together, you create the impression of arrogance. Phil Jackson, the legendary basketball coach, was once accused of being arrogant, and he said something similar to this, that they call me this because I've been successful, but I'm also kind of a low-key guy. Mm-hmm. And that's the way he was more comfortable. It's a little bit like Woodrow Wilson, more comfortable speaking at a podium than being around a table conversing with people with small talk. His wife, Kathleen, once said, Paul spoke better on his feet mm-hmm. than on his seat. And it's part of the interesting dimensions when you do a biography and you explore a single person in their life, you see these things and how people's strengths are the reciprocals of their weaknesses and how things could have been different at certain points. John has alluded to that. In 1932, we haven't really talked about this, but he opposed FDR's nomination in 1932. Yeah. That was not a surefire thing. FDR had to get the votes of 2/3 of the delegates, and he was short of that. He had a majority.
He would regret that decision.
Well, and he made an enduring enemy out
yes,
of that.
Yes, he did.
In Jim Farley.
Yes.
He made Jim Farley, who was head of the Democratic National Committee and was Postmaster General, never forgot that. And really, Roosevelt never forgot it, even though he gave him appointments later.
Yeah.
It was a case of, you know, there were certain points in McNutt's career as High Commissioner, the first go-around, Governor, and then going back as National Commander, where he could act pretty independently.
Yeah.
And when he went to Washington, he was drawn even more into a one-sided relationship with Franklin Roosevelt, where he became, I think, a mere instrumentality in a lot of ways of Roosevelt's will. And the chapter in the book, 1940, I chose to end it not with him not getting the nomination for vice president, but what happens in the fall campaign. And we were alluding to Wilkie. He becomes a kind of campaign surrogate, landing some verbal choice blows against a larger-than-life political newcomer whom he had long overshadowed.
But,
you know, in the 1940 convention, a gentleman from Martinsville told me, one of who worked for McNutt, McNutt had the votes to become vice president. That's one of the last times the convention elected the vice president independently of the president. And as in 32, he didn't pull the trigger to endorse FDR. He didn't want to buck FDR in 1940, and he deferred to FDR wanting Henry Wallace on the ticket. He could have been vice president, but he didn't do it. So there's a series of things. When he gets right up to the edge, he clutches, and he doesn't go forward. For all the ambition, he doesn't kind of blow through and get what he wants.
Well, and in reading the book, I got the sense— And I actually, the first question I asked you coming out of the gate was about being overshadowed by FDR, and that was deliberate, in part because you get the sense that, A, this is a guy who, up to that point, he had mastered almost every situation he'd been in his life, and, to be honest, mastered almost all other men, at least all other human beings he had encountered. They'd gotten them to defer to him, to follow him, and he finally ran into somebody who actually was better at at that than he was.
He definitely was. One of the things that I hope readers will get that is somewhat new, nothing about Franklin Roosevelt right now I think is completely new, but something that's often overlooked, is that he did not want to share the stage with anyone else. And McNutt was a potential rival in terms of sharing the public stage.
Well, they had an awful lot in common. I mean,
they did.
You know, FDR, early on, especially before the polio and all of that, was considered a very good-looking man, too. Mm-hmm. Incredibly articulate, with a lot of personal charm as well, and an ability to, you know, to persuade people to follow him. So you could see almost a kind of sibling thing, other than one's a patrician and the other came from Martinsville, Indiana. But in that sense, you know, I guess where I'd like to go, and we've got just a little bit of time here before we go to the break, where did the sense of compassion that John was alluding to come from? Because, pointed out, Martinsville is not a place, particularly at that time, that you would go for enlightenment on ethnic or racial matters.
Well, for what he did in the Philippines was amazing.
Well, I think what John was alluding to here is a search and a detective story, and there are a number of threads in the story. And one of the things is you can be from Martinsville or from some place that's not very tolerant and become intolerant, or you can be so affected by that you go in the other direction.
And what was his journey, though?
And you know something? We don't have those kinds of sources. But the one thing that I pointed out is that when his family moved into Martinsville, they were outsiders. Okay. And his mother dressed him like a Lord Fauntleroy. And he was bullied in school. And apparently he was bullied repeatedly.
And told that he couldn't fight back.
And told it by initially. His parents that he couldn't fight back. And this is where, I think, why he obeyed Franklin Roosevelt. He had all of this ambition, but not this real rebellion of going against a kind of authority figure, like a parent or a commander-in-chief. So that's something to keep in mind. But I think he had some sort of sensitivity to victims of persecution.
And that's where, you know, it came to, you know, when we get on the other side of the break, I do want to talk about this sort of Schindler-like story here. Because it's really the second chapter. If you are just joining us, we are talking in the special recorded No Limits about the life and legacy of Paul McNutt, in honoring the publication of a splendid new biography of McNutt. Our guests are Dean Kotlowski, who's the biographer, and John Krause, who kind of midwifed the book into creation. Again, we're not taking calls or questions via email or social media. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the life and legacy of Indiana Governor Paul McNutt. The springboard is the publication of a splendid new biography of McNutt called Paul V. McNutt and the Age of FDR by Dean J. Kutlowski. We're talking with Dean Kutlowski and John Kraus, who is a distant but not so distant cousin of McNutt's, who played an integral role in getting the book published and into creation. Again, because this is a recorded show, we're not taking calls. We also will not be taking questions or comments via email or social media. Well, we've alluded to this in the previous segment, but the whole story of how McNutt becomes kind of a Hoosier Oscar Schindler, if you can wrap your head around that, without sort of the bon vivant and the, you know, somewhat elastic interpersonal morality that Schindler had. Talk to us a little bit about that. I'm going to start with Dean, but John as well. I want you to chime in.
Okay. Well, I think when you think of him as a Hoosier Oscar Schindler, there are about 1,000 Jews who Oscar Schindler saved in the context of World War II. And the number of Jews who made it to Manila while McNutt was High Commissioner, largely at McNutt's instigation, is about 1,300. So it's comparable to a certain extent in that sense. We also want to think about that we've talked about his presidential ambitions and how, you know, they didn't materialize and he didn't get his lifelong goal. But American history is replete with would-be nominees of presidential political parties and presidential nominees of political parties and things like that. But how many people really took action in the period of the refugee crisis of the 30s and the Holocaust to save lives? And that was McNutt. I would stress this is that the State the overwhelming sentiments in the country were against refugees and immigrants because it was the Depression and anti-Semitism was there and it existed and you had to deal with it. And Roosevelt knew. Roosevelt had some sympathies. He knew, though, he was told, if you try to revise the quota system that, you know, of keeping immigrants out, you go to Congress, you're going to get more restrictions. You're not going to get fewer. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about McNutt, he really exploits loopholes in the law. It's not like he's going against the law, but the loopholes in the law are this. One is that because immigration to the U.S. was so low and the Philippines was part of the U.S. and it was under the U.S. flag, those quotas were not being filled for Germany and Austria. Mm-hmm. So Jews could come if they could get visas, and they could come if they could prove they would not be a public charge, meaning that they had to have skills that would abet the local community and that they would be able to find jobs. And so McNutt understood that you could get German and Austrian Jews of certain occupations and skill sets, and you could actually bring them out of Germany and Austria to the Philippines, where some of the skills were needed. And President Manuel Quezon of the Philippines was looking to build up his country's economy. That's one of the things he's thinking about. He's thinking about many things. But here was an opportunity. And McNutt knew that if this became widely known, it would upset people in Washington and among the general public. So he said, well, it's a little bit like with Nixon and civil rights. Let's be low-key.
Let's just do it.
Let's just do it. Let's not brag about it. Mm-hmm. Let's let the deeds speak for themselves. And if we can bring certain refugees in of a certain type who can get jobs, we can bring more in. And so he wanted this to be handled, quote unquote, right. And that's how they would handle it, right? There was a family in Manila, the Frieder brothers. These were American Jewish cigar manufacturers from Cincinnati. So nice Midwestern connection here. And they did a lot to help to resettle the Jews. But one of the, I may have alluded to this earlier, one of the powers that the High Commissioner to the Philippines had was to waive visa restrictions.
He had
coming
it in
into
his own power.
Yeah.
He had that in his power. And so he knew that, and he could exploit that. Now, this happens incrementally. There's a documentary that stresses how a number of gentlemen, Manuel Quezon, the Frieder brothers, Paul McNutt, they also throw Dwight Eisenhower. Colonel Eisenhower. But I'm not sure Eisenhower was all that actively involved. McNutt and Eisenhower played golf together. So they were friends and stuff like that. But over these poker games, some of the ideas, came to fruition. But I think more than poker, McNutt and Kazan were united by a love of power. And they knew the uses of power. And they knew that you could do certain things within the context of the law that were creative, that could help people.
I want to bring John in here because this is a part of McNutt's legacy that even in Indiana today is not widely known or understood. I mean, and you were saying before we went on the air that it came as something of a revelation to
you,
too.
Well, I'm going through all of Louise's papers after she died.
And that is your cousin, McNutt's daughter, we should
say. So then I find a program of McNutt's inauguration in 1933 on the western steps of the State House. And I look down the program, McNutt's a Methodist, and here's a Jewish rabbi who's giving a prayer.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, we're just coming out of Klan country here, and this is very conservative, and that's kind of gutsy for McNutt for his big deal. He's going to be governor of Indiana. So then I'm seeing in the papers Jewish awards. It's like the detective story. It doesn't make sense. But then finally I got a call from a fellow that was writing a book about his father, and his father was escaping the Philippines when the Japanese invaded. And he said he wanted to interview Louise. Well, her sickness couldn't do it. Turns out that his father was one of the Jews that was led into the Philippines when McNutt signed the visa. Well, long and short of it is that the Frieders and the Holocaust Museum in Cincinnati, they were all going to honor what Kazan and McNutt and others did, and the family. They brought the ambassador out from the Philippines. So I was asked to go down to represent the McNutt family. Well, I'm standing in this temple up on the altar, and I'm looking out into the audience, and I'm seeing all these little grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking to myself, if McNutt had not done what he did, they would not be alive. They would not be here. And so that you can see, you know, in graphic fashion, what that meant to future generations into a whole set of folks that had a history and had a future because of McNutt.
Well, and I'm going to ask this question now because we've established, I mean, he is perhaps the most significant governor in the state's history. You know, you've got this story.
John, I would certainly
say. Story of really dedicated service, you know, in a time of real horror in human history. All of these, you know, roles that he filled in regard to the war and the Philippines. And, you know, we forget, we haven't really talked about the fact that he had some role, too, in establishing Indiana University as much more of an academic and intellectual powerhouse than it was. I mean, he was just at the beginning of that process, but he was there. So why is he so little remembered today? I mean, and I guess where I'm going with that is, people still talk about Wendell Willkie and that the whole junior, you know, the junior partner thing when Willkie became the nominee and all of that. Why has, to some degree, Willkie been remembered and McNutt been forgotten?
Well, I think the answer to that is McNutt has been forgotten. The easy answer is because he never became president. And we tend to forget, unfortunately, our non-presidents. But we at least give some recognition in the history books to people who win the nominations of the party. And, you know, carry the fall campaign to whoever wins. So they get, a footnote, but maybe it's a bigger footnote. And because of that time period in 1940, Willkie got even a bigger footnote. Mm-hmm. Because he not only helped to lead the country in a more internationalist direction, but also afterwards served Roosevelt in terms of getting support for Lend-Lease. But again, that doesn't adequately answer your question either, because McNutt was an internationalist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very much an internationalist. Now, they're a little bit on opposite sides. I call them the odd couple of Indiana politics in some way. But they share certain values, you know, an active state at home and an active country's, the United States' foreign policy abroad. And I think that's part of it. And I think also the long delay for many reasons in getting a biography of McNutt
mm-hmm.
has allowed him to become a kind of forgotten figure.
John, I mean, you know, obviously you've been in and around Indiana politics, public policy. one of the revelations is realizing in reading Dean's book just how much we still live in Paul McNutt's Indiana, well, how much of Indiana state government he shaped and
the whole personnel system, statehouse reorganization into various.
Well, and really making the governor an important figure in some ways.
And then there's politics. Then he helped
the 2%
create
the 2% club. Yeah, we need to get that in there.
And the party was the system, and the number of patronage jobs was throughout the whole state government. But he was the leader, and he was able to get things through both houses of the Indiana General Assembly, and there was an agenda. For someone who was a one-term governor, there was no lame duck with him at all. Mm-hmm. Right now, if someone's one term, you know, the first year is probably, you know, the heyday, and then it's downhill after that. That was not the case with McNutt. You know, it's sad at the end, because McNutt goes to the Philippines. Truman asks him to return and prepare the Philippines for independence. So McNutt is really responsible for the writing of the Philippine Constitution and what the Philippines turned into, and it's evolved, good or bad, since then. So then he went back to practice law, and I think he just got depressed after that because he was starting to make money, and he and Kathleen traveled. But in this era, there was a lot of smoking going on, and he was a pipe smoker and a cigar smoker. And he had an unfortunate death of throat cancer, and he was on a cruise in the Pacific. And Eisenhower had to send an army plane out to pick him up. And he's buried on a hill in Arlington, just down from JFK's, and it's a rather prominent hill, and the view of Washington is significant. But he's kind of viewing what he wanted to be part of.
Yeah. Do you share that? And your relationship, obviously, with McNutt is going to be different than John's for all sorts. There are some generational differences in the fact, I'm assuming, you're not from Indiana originally and all of that. Do you have that sense that he was kind of a depressed figure at the end of his life? I mean, did he take any satisfaction from most of us? You know, you're governor of a state. Most of us would be very, very thrilled to be able to say, not just 1,300 lives, but 1,300 familial lines have been preserved because of my efforts. All of the other accomplishments that he had. Did he consider himself a success at the end of his life, or was it because he didn't get to the White House he thought of himself as a failure?
I do see him as a kind of tragic figure in terms of the way in which he was forgotten. And I close the book by talking about this bust of McNutt. There are two busts at Indiana University. Yeah. One where he
in
McNutt Quadrangle, where I don't even think there's a nameplate there. I mean, there's certainly nothing to indicate. And this bust, had been left to waste in a southern Indiana town of Jasper. But get back to your question, and it was forgotten, and eventually was taken to McNutt Quadrangle. The bust was, and it was. It's there, and I don't think people understand what the relationship of that bust and that quadrangle are. Who are we honoring here? I think McNutt was proud of his career. His office was decked out with things that were reminders, artifacts, souvenirs,
flags
from the Philippines, political cartoons, things like that. You can read that another way. It's like trying to remind other people that he had once been pretty prominent. And he fought to stay in the national conversation in a number of ways. He would come back to Indiana and would campaign for candidates. And it's what you want a real tragedy here? A lot of the things in terms of his political philosophy, and I talk about that, anti-totalitarianism, a strong national defense, a welfare state, these sorts of things that would come together in Cold War liberalism, that's his time, right? And he's off the political stage at that point. It's almost like the man, the message, and the moment had merged just as he was losing relevance. And he might have been a leader of post-war liberalism. He was younger than Truman by 7 years, and he was older than JFK and Adlai Stevenson, okay? And yet it just wasn't in the cards. The timing wasn't right. The decisions he made weren't right. And then, you know, to get back where you started, the larger-than-life figure of Franklin D. Roosevelt, four terms. I mean, the state of Indiana very much in the shadow of Paul McNutt, but the country, when you think about it,
yeah.
To paraphrase William E. Luchtenberg, the historian, in the shadow of FDR.
Well, and that the cliche is that, you know, from 1932 until really the election of Ronald Reagan, we lived in FDR's America.
Yeah.
Is that, John, you know, we've got just a little bit of time left here. Did you ever talk with Louise about, about her father's legacy and, you know, why he wasn't held, you know, in the sort of regard or renown that...
She was upset about that. Because she said he didn't get his due. And there was a book that really didn't meet par. And I wish this had happened why many of the people that Dean read the papers of were alive and could have told the story in much more colorful and graphic way. Because I think he would have been recognized in a much better, positive light then. But, you know, I'm very happy the book is here, and I'm happy that it's well done. I hope Hoosiers get to know him. I sent one to Mitch Daniels, and he said he'd read a lot about McNutt, but he hadn't read McNutt, read what other people said about McNutt. So he was looking forward to reading the book. Daniels had a portrait by Wayman Adams in the governor's series of portraits, and it was hanging in his office while he was there. So there was a philosophy of organize, do well, look at your goals, and that's what McNutt did during his tenure. I think Daniels did it during his.
So real quickly, since we are really tight on time, Dean, and then I'll give John the last word here, sum up, you know, how we should remember Paul McNutt in a sentence or two, real tightly.
I think he's somebody who could have been a great man in terms of being president of the United States, but who left an enormous footprint in Indiana politics and a somewhat smaller footprint, but a significant one in national and international politics.
John,
he was
just
a humanitarian sentence. That saw public service as his calling, and he rose to the occasion and fulfilled it very well.
I'd like to thank both of you. I'm in your debt for teaching me something about this complicated figure that I knew something about, but not nearly enough. We've been talking about the life and legacy of Paul McNutt with Dean Kutlowski and John Krause. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.